years in prison, but the judge sentenced him to just 6 months in county jail, of which he served 3 months. The judge, Aaron Persky, was later recalled by California voters. The victim impact statement Chanel Miller read during the trial went viral and was read by millions around the world. Visit democracynow.org to see Chanel reading highlights of that victim impact statement. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tay Maria Studio, and Maria Terracena, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Food, Ishmael Gudaro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Learning different methods and ways to prepare delicious food is necessary today. Eating habits vary based on people's childhoods, access to food, and nutritional education. Henry Ford College Culinary Arts Program has two tracks to support your career and healthy lifestyle. Contact HFCC Culinary Arts Department at 313-845-9600 or email enroll@hfcc.edu. For more information. Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for blues music on Highway 61 Friday 2 till 4 p.m. Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases in Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.
It's time for the annual WHFR Record Show. One day only, Saturday, October 19th, on the campus of Henry Ford College, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. $5 early admission at 9 a.m. More than 25 vendors all under one roof. Hundreds of CDs, vinyl records, cassette tapes, videos, and memorabilia. Pick up some WHFR swag. Prize giveaways every hour. Shop early. Stay late. But if you miss it, you'll have to wait until next year. That's why it's called Annual. The WHFR Annual Record Show. One day only. Saturday, October 19th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Do not miss it.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.
Hello and happy Friday. Welcome to the WHFR Journal. I'm Susan McGraw along with Alan Mazurek, and we have a very adventurous program, I think that's the word for today, Alan, to share with our listeners.
We do indeed. There's a few things going on the HFC campus, Career Day coming up, but also actually because last Friday was College Radio Day, we weren't on the air, we want to, I guess for us, officially start the month of October looking at Hispanic Heritage Month. So, ¿cómo está?
Oh, and I'm going to bring the guests
in.
I'm fine, thank you. We are so excited to be seeing a familiar face in our WHFR studios, as well as a face that looks kind of like the familiar face, but not exactly, if you know what I mean. And we are talking about a film that is being presented literally this weekend, and we just can't tell you enough about it. Ellen and I are pretty knowledgeable about what's going on with the basic who, what, when, where, why, and how, but we wanted to bring in the experts, and these are the guys that are really literally responsible for this film. Ralph Valdez is here wearing a different hat today. Actually, all of his hats are off.
Yes.
Because he is here as Ralph Valdez, so
Thank you. So
happy to have you here, as well as Len Rajewski, who is the first cousin of Ralph Valdez.
Yes, we're two of 70.
Yeah, two of 70.
Well, I was trying, you know, when, full disclosure, I've known Ralph on and off, for better or for worse, for over 30 years, and I always knew he had a big family. But until I started to see this film, I didn't understand how big a family and like what the levels of cousins are and things like that. So let's just sort of start off with this idea of from Michoacan to Michigan, which is the film that's going to be shown this Sunday at the Detroit Institute of Arts in the Detroit Film Theater, how it came to be. And let's see, I got like seven people in my family, and we all want to tell their story. And there are a lot of people that want to tell their family's stories and record oral history, but where did it come from?
Well, I'll keep it pretty succinct here. Back in the late 80s, I guess I was becoming a little bit more aware of my Mexican heritage. And we've always had stories in our family.
What's the last name? Let's start there.
Fraga. F-R-A-G-A.
Okay. Yeah. Well, your last name.
Oh, mine, the last name is Rajeski.
There you go.
Okay.
There we go.
Yeah. So, as you'll come to find out at some point, that only Ralph's mother actually married another Mexican. All the rest of the other 10 siblings married non-Mexicans. So that's how I got involved with the family.
I always say, this is just a quick aside, that the Mexicans and the Polish people have a lot in common. Salt of the earth, working class, love big weddings and big parties and funerals. They always are very respectful as well. So I just feel like there's a lot of similarities in the cultures and love to eat.
So for the story, we started in Michoacan, right?
Well, probably Michigan. I mean... Okay. Because, well, I'm showing...
How far back do you want to go, though?
Well...
So I think...
How the film came about, which leads to the story.
There you go. Thank you.
And I was teaching video production at Lakeland High School and Milford High School in Huron Valley. And things started to come together. I've heard the story in the family. It was all oral history. And people have different versions of, you know, in all families, many different versions of oral histories. And I had the resources of a very nice professional studio at my Beckham. I shouldn't put it that way, but
at your disposal.
At my disposal, there we go. And it all started to come together. So as I started trying to research, what happened in the family was that there was this two versions, basically, that our grandparents left right after the Mexican Revolution in, let's say, 1918, 1919. And they made their way to the border at Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, Texas. And I'll give some backstory later, but once they had crossed, they were recruited to go to Michigan in Laredo, Texas. And after this long journey of getting there, there was some initial confusion by my grandfather, our grandfather, that he thought they said Michoacan. So the state that they had left, Michoacan, was engulfed in the revolution and the aftermath.
And for geography's sake, it's sort of on the, well, it starts on the Pacific coast, but really goes inland almost all the way to Mexico City.
Correct.
Not too far away. Yeah, okay.
Correct. It's northwest of Mexico City. Yeah. And so... When they were recruited and they heard Michigan, I'm sorry, there was initial confusion. And he was tired and feeling sick, according to the story. And he was a little confused. But before he ever got on the train, turns out other fellow Mexicans and other people had told him, no, you know, you're going to Michigan, and tried to describe where they were going.
But the way they pronounced Michigan was even confusing, because they would say Michigan.
Right. So you can understand that.
Michoacan, Michigan.
There was a whole lot of confusion. But lo and behold, when they did get on the train, our grandfather and grandmother and their oldest two children, they were one of 16 cars in Laredo, Texas, to go to Saginaw, Michigan. So this, we're talking 100 years ago, and I had no idea that it was that prevalent of recruiting going on at that point, not 100 years ago, but anyway.
Right.
So that's, on top of all that, in the late 60s, early 70s, two of their sons, our uncles, had actually dabbled in technology, had audio recorders, and one of them recorded our grandparents' story in English, and the other one recorded their story in Spanish. So I had these incredible resources that, as I started to research the story, I heard various versions from various aunts and uncles, and I didn't want to start getting too political about whose story to believe, and I ended up going back to their own words, because how can anybody dispute what Grandpa and Grandma said?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the genesis of all this, and then did a lot of research, did a trip back to Texas and Mexico, retraced their steps. We put this production together back in the early 90s. At that point, it was mostly for family and friends. We showed it in an auditorium. We had a great time, mariachis and all that. But now, 20-some years later, I realized our nieces and nephews, my own daughters, don't know the story. We have this incredible story in our family. And then, with everything else going on in the world, it was time to bring it back, improve it, update it, and that's what this Sunday's all about, is showing.
And it's fortuitous also, as you said, because it is the 100-year anniversary of their journey, of their crossing from 1919 to 2019.
Yeah, it was kind of meant to happen, I guess, because mm-hmm. it took me a little longer than I thought to get to this point, but it was meant to happen 100 years.
Both grandparents no longer living,
correct.
We will assume. How long did their lives continue to flourish through the telling of this story and through other connections with family?
So obviously they were still doing well when Len began to research, trying to get to the story, the true story of what their journey was like. And so that was back in the 90s, and they lived up until, let's see, I think Grandpa lived until he was 90 or 91, and Grandma into her 70s. She had more health issues, but we had moved them from the farm to right around the block from where I grew up, because my mother was the daughter that Len referred to, one of their children that they brought over. Mm. So she came over as a child, making us first-generation Mexican-Americans. They had good long lives, and they were always sharing these stories and telling, and then through our many aunts and uncles and through my many siblings, brothers and sisters, we would hear these stories growing up, and it was wonderful for Len to be able to go back to Mexico, retrace the steps of our grandparents with a couple of our living uncles who were living at the time, and one still is with us, and that was, you know, pretty much the genesis of the project.
Well, and we've been lucky because of having such a large family. We're probably, as I mentioned earlier, our grandparents had 11 children.
Mm-hmm.
The first daughter died in Mexico before they left, but then 11, two in Mexico were born, and the rest were here. And they all had large families, most of them did, back in the 50s and 60s, like so many other families.
Not as large as ours.
Ralph, you say yourself, you know how large Ralph's family is?
There's a cousin rivalry here, right?
No, there's no competition.
I come from a family of 16. I have 10 sisters and 5 other brothers. I'm one of 16. I'm the youngest of the boys. And so, yes, we have a wonderful storytelling history and, you know, sharing of family things, and the fact that our grandparents had a farm that we could go to every summer as we grew up.
So the story, you know, quote unquote, begins in 1919. And obviously, probably, you know, they and their families had been there for generations. Mexican Revolution, this is just after World War I. There's a lot of political upheaval. As you went back and retraced their roots, you know, how did that journey north begin, and maybe they were not unique in that. You said there were, you know, 16 cars on the train. What was it that drove them north?
Well, and again, the more we tell the story, I digress for a second, the more that I find it resonating with so many other Mexican-American families, with other immigrant families. Sometimes the details are different, but I've learned more in the second go-around than I even learned the first go-around. There's books out there that I didn't know existed that really talk about Mexican-Americans and Mexicans in Michigan going back to the 20s and the communities that we have around the area. So these stories, as you referenced, are very similar to many other stories. So back then, one of the things I've learned, and I'm not a historian, but it wasn't just the revolution. It was just a very chaotic time in Mexico with the government situation, with some of the revolutionaries, with other openings for bandit type situations. And
yeah, we grew up hearing stories of the bandidos, and my grandparents talked often of going down roads and seeing people hung if they didn't comply with these. You know, there's a fine line between the revolutionaries and the bandits sometimes, and they would try to take over people's farms. And so I think they were having such a difficult time that was part of the reason that drove them north.
So they farmed at the time, and when we think of the like late teens and early 20s, we think of the, like, you know, the field to factory migration that took place here in the United States, but it turned into a field to field migration, right? Well, to come up to Saginaw and sugar beet farming. Yeah,
because, well, there's a couple of things there. He was actually a caballero. He was a cowboy, and was a ranch hand when he was in his prime as a young guy. And he wanted to be close to the land, and that's how they grew up, and they were outside. And so that was all going on in his brain and in his mind in terms of having to leave a place they loved. And then that's one of the things that I think persists through the story, is that we all somehow transcends our family without being preached to about it, at least in my case, that we're proud of our Mexican heritage, and they're proud of Mexicans are part of their country. And then so when they left, they still brought those traditions, like so many other immigrant families, again, kept those traditions going in the family, and just how they spoke, they talked, the food, pinata parties, you name it, those are all just part of how we grew up.
The clothes, everything.
And then it's too easy to get astray, I apologize.
Oh, no, no, no. It's fascinating.
But it's my own daughters, who now, I'm half Mexican, they're a quarter Mexican, yet I'm so proud of the fact that their Mexican heritage somehow transcends all that, more so than, I hate to say it, the other
ethnicities
in their background.
Three-fourths, yeah, yeah.
And because they're just, something resonates with them. So going back to our grandfather back in the farm, when he hit Saginaw, they were, what you come to find out is that many of the people in Mexico were recruited either for working in the fields, specifically beets, sugar beets, or the foundries, or the railroads. Foundries and Ford Motor, there's a huge connection to Ford Motor for the Mexican-American community. So when they hit Saginaw, he wound up in the foundry, but he just... back then, a foundry, especially compared to even now, but it was just not a place for healthy and the air, and he just couldn't be there long. And then he ended up working and his family in the fields in the Thumb area, and his return to his roots. And it's like a sharecropper situation where, and I still don't have a great handle on it, but farmers in that area would actually hire a family, in essence, and they'd have a home on that property, a second home to the farmers, and they might live there for a year or two, almost like a contractual situation, and they would be there for a length of time and at some point would move on to another family. And they did that in the North Branch, Marlette, Burnside, in that area of Michigan. So he returned to his roots of being on the land. And one of the crazy things in my mind, I'm 68, I think, and I retired a few years ago, and I was getting ready to retire, but he got his first farm, he and our grandmother, he was 60 years old, and he loved every minute of it, his first farm of his own. And if you look at the pictures, it was pretty rough, but he didn't even think about the house, it was all about the land. And so that thread runs through the story, as well as when you go back to Michoacán, it has a lot of similarities to Michigan in terms of lakes. It's not what people often think of when they think of Mexico. Mm. It's there's a lot of similarities in the in the land.
The story is the film From Michoacan to Michigan. It's going to be showing at the Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of, at the Detroit Institute of Arts this Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month, our guests are Len Rejewski, and Ralph Valdez talking about the film and the family that made this entire story possible.
You know, gentlemen, we have opportunities to dig into our heritage through things like Ancestry.com and, you know, the DNA swabs that you can send in and get the report. I found out just not that long ago I'm 10% Greek, so now I know why I like the Greek culture and Greek food
and
so
much.
And
why you're such a good dancer.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure.
And why you're always setting the cheese on fire.
Whether on purpose or on accident, right? But it, you know, this obviously goes way, you know, way, way, way farther than that. And I know that 10% Greek thing that I found out, based on what I read, likely I'll never be able to pursue these types of stories with that. So I think that's what makes this one so unique. I always considered myself half Polish, half Italian, which is why I like to eat as well. Oh. But ultimately, you know, it's not until you start asking those questions and calling people out on the stories that they've been willing to tell and literally doing that documentation that makes this get to a point to where it will be on Sunday. And that's so rare. It's
what
so
unique. I was going to say, what I find fascinating is that this journey, you know, to the screen at the DFT on Sunday sort of began in the 1960s with those recordings in Spanish and in English, and then obviously has been sort of like filled out and fleshed out with everybody's individual interpretations that you've interviewed from this huge family. I don't know if you talk to everybody and what their take on it is.
No, and that's one of the themes, again, going back to my video production days, number one, and understanding that this is a resource. If our uncles were doing it 30, 40 years ago with those crazy big old audio reel-to-reel recorders, how easy, relatively, it is for anybody now with these great smartphones,
with
the quality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no reason. And one of the things we hope to do after this is one of the organizations I'm a part of, Digital Arts Film and Television. It used to be called, well, it's DAFT still, but they originally were Detroit Area Film Teachers, who is also our fiduciary agent. But one of the things, their mission is to work with teachers and students on video production skills and things like that. And we're hoping some type of outreach with, again, with teachers and students, how to develop those skills of interviewing and getting that information, even helping with equipment if it's some people may need that help. But because there's no reason that it shouldn't be going on with everybody now.
And I'll tell you, I think one of the reasons why people that might be well-intentioned to want to start this process ultimately will find a roadblock or two or start to feel overwhelmed because it's not as easy as it's going to look on Sunday, really, when we watch this. There's so much involved, as we know, working in this field ourselves. It's the correct, you know, balance of the audio versus the video, how many stills versus how much footage, you know, moving footage versus the, you know, the score, as well as the writing and the timing, and every production like this must have its own heartbeat, its own pacing, and so on. And somebody's got to be responsible for all that.
From a historical perspective, some of it comes down to luck. Like that it survived.
Well, yeah, and it's got to be accurate.
Those reel-to-reel tapes could have been in a, you know, trash can at Myrtle and 18th, you know, 20 years ago, and nobody would have known about
them. Right. But I also think it doesn't, if you don't have the material to begin with, you can't do anything with it. And so even if they're acquiring it at whatever level, as long as it's decent quality, the right person comes along and those archives are there. And I encourage people to archive photos and recordings. And then the right person comes along that has the resources or the skills or whatever combination, then to take those pieces and create the stories. Because, but you have to have the product. I mean, the more original you can get to the product of the original source.
The material, yeah. And then, you know, the interest may skip a generation, but the stuff will be there for the next generation, for the kids or the grandkids that want to really dig deep into their history.
Well, when you say next generation, I mean, yeah, for a story like this, 100 years in the making. And, you know, to be honest, you may be unique among people that were part of that migration from specifically, you know, Michoacán to Michigan, exactly, or from Mexico Texas to somewhere else in the United States. You know, is you know, do you see this as something that, you know, can spread further than just here, the local audience, that it's part of their heritage here in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's so much potential with this work that my cousin Len has been lovingly creating and crafting for so many years, and now reviving and freshening up. And I think it can be used for educational purposes. I think it can be used as, in, I could see going to the circuit of film festivals. And it's just, it's a story that is really universal and resonates with anybody that's has grandparents, you know, anybody that has a story of a journey from someplace else, since we all come from someplace else. And I did want to say quickly before we run out of time that the film is showing for free this Sunday, October 13th. The program begins at 2 p.m., and it's at the Detroit Film Theater of the DIA. And if you can also go to our website page, which is just Michoacán to Michigan, and that's spelled M-I-C-H-O-A-C-A-N-T-O. Michigan, M-I-C-H-I-G-A-N. And then the Facebook page is the same. You can find out a lot of fun information there on Facebook. But the website, Michoacán to Michigan, will also be helpful. So the story of this journey that our grandparents took is told through photographs and memories and interviews and oral histories, and it really comes to life on the film, in the film, with a soundtrack that was current, a new soundtrack provided by Tish Hinojosa. And then there's also going to be live mariachi band, the really, really talented band called Mariachis Jalisco de Detroit, that are going to be moving throughout the film theater and the DIA, and then ending up on stage right before the program begins at 2 p.m.
Wow, just fantastic.
So working on the film began in 1994.
Late 80s, probably. Okay.
And so 30 years now, it's a different environment and different political environment when we talk about things like, especially Mexican to, you know, United States immigration. Does that factor into your mind at all as you revisit the project, or?
It definitely is an element. I've purposely avoided any direct political inferences because the story is so obvious and inherent in its own right, and it tells its own story. But part of that story that I were trying to also get into is the fact that because of their journey 100 years ago, there's over 300 of us, like Ralph and myself and all the folks and the Abdus and the Rastonis and the assessors and all of us that that all came from that original journey, that we're here, we're doing our jobs, we're paying our taxes.
It's a uniquely American story, one way or the other.
Medical profession. Contributing to the fabric.
Yeah, we're part of this fabric, yeah. and that's just us, let alone so
others.
Many other ethnicities families. And immigrants. Sure. That and then it's partially to say, wait a minute, you know, part of what people see on the media sometimes is very narrow of how it's depicted, and we're just saying there's more to that story of what Mexican-American families bring to the table, what we have been doing for hundreds of years. In fact, the crazy, one of the things that I hear more and more, and it just, our daughter lives in New Mexico, and every time I visit there and start understanding how the border crossed the people that have lived there well before there was United States, and it's all messed up. People need to do their history. They need to understand.
You're saying there's a New Mexico now?
That even predates Mexico in terms of...
It's from The Simpsons.
The people... I really encourage people to understand situations and history and the development of our country in Mexico and everything else before they sometimes say things that aren't as accurate as they might think.
It just deepens the picture, the appreciation, the understanding of what any family of immigrants brings and what their story is that makes up what the United States is and what the wonderful beauty of America is. So I think it's, as Len's saying, it doesn't, it's self-evident without having to beat anybody over the head with the politics of the story because it's just so obvious, I think.
Yeah. And this is Hispanic Heritage Month, and right. That's most appropriate to be talking about these themes and these concepts with this specific opportunity.
Exactly.
I have to ask, Len, are you considered the director, if you will? And because somebody in the course of these hundreds of people and
producer, director,
yes, somebody has to. It's sort of like the final decision. The buck sort of has to stop with someone, and I don't know in this family that I would want to have the responsibility.
No,
but somebody has to finally make those difficult.
I've called myself the producer.
Okay.
I think executive producer, people don't fully understand what that is. And producer, I think, is what I do. And my talents are, I think, that way. Organizing, collaborating, the famous phrase of herding. I mean,
this is the story I think we should tell, and everybody else is allowed to help me tell it.
Well, we are so lucky. Out of our team, almost everyone is a direct member of our family.
I was going to say, name drop them if you want.
All right. Our editor was a former student of mine who went on to editing at Columbia College, and now she's a young woman with a young family. But she's the daughter of our cousin, besides being a former student.
Mm.
And that cousin also is a double cousin. So my mother and her sister married my dad and his brother. So a double first cousin once removed or whatever. So
cousin twice. Yeah, I've got a couple of those in my family, too.
I don't have a big enough piece of paper.
That's just Julie.
The family tree's going off the page.
And then Carrie, who's our social media director and graphic designer, is my niece from my brother's. And she's done to bring her to the table to understand social media, which I don't, but I know it exists and it needs. The fact that we have over 700 people reserved for Sunday, which, and I get an email of all the RSVPs, and over half is not family that I don't recognize. So the power of social media can have some positive effects
as well. I think the point, one of the points Len's making is that there's a younger generation with new ideas and comfortable with new technology and new ways of getting the word out that we're very lucky that are in our family that are helping with this film. And then also the second point is that the DFT and the DIA folks have told us that independent films and locally made films, they're lucky if they get a couple of hundred people on a Sunday afternoon for that mm-hmm. sort of thing. So we're already at 700, but the place holds 1,100. So we want everyone listening to come out and check the film out this coming Sunday at 2 p.m. at the DFT.
Well, I know Len Rejewski reluctantly agreed to be here. But apparently, he didn't give you much time to talk, Ralph. Why don't you give us the details on the showing from Michoacan Michigan, which is coming up this Sunday.
Oh, no, I thought this has been a wonderful, give and take conversation all around. Seriously, but the film is at the Detroit Film Theater of the Detroit Institute of Arts. There's plenty of parking available, and it's coming up this Sunday, October 13th. The doors open at 12:30 p.m. at the DFT. The program will begin at 2 p.m. There'll be a cash bar in the Crystal Gallery and cash snacks. The mariachis will be performing throughout and ending up on the stage just before the program begins. The DIA itself opens at 10 a.m. this Sunday, and there'll be ofrendas and other things celebrating Mexican and Spanish culture, so you can check all that out. I think Sugar Skulls might be available. So there's going to be a lot of wonderful
murals.
Things. The murals, of course, the Diego Rivera murals.
And have lunch.
And our cousin Ed is a famous Detroit-based painter, Ed Fraga, who has a piece in the Modern Galleries at the DIA, so we're very proud of that as well. So he'll be on hand. He's been part of the team. My family, who are the Mexican side, but since, as Len mentioned,
I know we made it to Imlay City, but we never made it down to Detroit, but maybe we'll save that
for another time,
day.
Because you guys have been so generous with your time. Thank you for letting us talk about this.
No, it sounds fantastic. We have to encourage others to be inspired by this story and also the process of telling this story. So it's really a twofold learning lesson, I think, here.
Yes, document your stories.
Yeah, and it's never too late to start, in fact, right?
It's amazing. I mean, yes, you can record everything with your phone, but none of it stays there once your phone is full and you do a wipe of your memory. It's gone. Here's a case where it just, fortunately for all of us, happened to be preserved.
Well, and there's ways to address that, and I'd be happy if on our website, michoacandemichigan.com, there is a place to contact us. So if ever someone wants to follow up on.
Other families have similar stories
or thoughts, or we're going to, there's some other venues we'll be showing down the road, as well as making connections with the Latino American community, as well as other immigrant families that want to tell their story. So the whole point is helping people make connections and spread what we know to help other people.
Well, we're so happy to have you here to do that for us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So much more than reading a press release. You know, this is fantastic.
Thank you.
Best of luck. Great success on Sunday. I'm sure it will be. And we look forward to talking to you both again after the fact at some point, just to get the follow-up and continue to learn from your experience.
Great to meet you guys
and having us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Likewise.
It's the WHFR Journal. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Please do stay with us this Friday afternoon.
Attention, crafters and record enthusiasts. WHFR is hosting our very first Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar, which is taking place alongside our 12th annual record show on October 19th. For over a decade, the record show has been a great source for hard-to-find music and memorabilia. And now you can also find one-of-a-kind handmade items by local artists all under one roof. Please visit WHFR.fm for more details. We hope to see you at WHFR's Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar and Record Show on Saturday, October 19th.
WHFR has brand new buttons, and we want you to have one for free. We are going old school with this promotion. Simply send us a postcard. Yeah, a real-life postcard with your name and address to WHFR Attention Buttons, 5101 Evergreen Road, Dearborn, Michigan, 48128. Let us know if you like blue or black better.
Attention, crafters and record enthusiasts. WHFR is hosting our very first Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar, which is taking place alongside our 12th annual record show on October 19th. We are still accepting vendor applications for both events. The 19th is fast approaching, so if you're a crafter or record slinger, be sure to send in your vendor apps for WHFR's Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar and record show as soon as possible.
This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. Thank you so much for being with us this Friday afternoon as we look at things going on in and around our campus community and the community at large. It is so great to have more, you know, guests with us to talk about things that are going on, especially here on the HFC campus.
Yeah, one of the things that I find most exciting about the options available to our students, aside from what they're getting in the classroom, is on the outside of our classroom walls, there are so many advantages to basically tap into. One of them falls in our career services office area, and we have invited Chad Austin, the career services officer here at Henry Ford College, to talk about the upcoming Career Expo 2019. We've had Chad in before talking about this, but sounds like this could be bigger and better than last year, and what that means is positive opportunities for our students on a number of different platforms. So it's right around the corner, so let's just jump in and say welcome to you, Chad. Glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. Always fun to be here. Alan and Susan, thank you for taking the time today to talk to me.
Oh, sure. When we start the idea of the Office of Career Services, what is the sort of the range of opportunities available to students in general? And then we can kind of focus specifically on the event coming up this coming Thursday.
Absolutely. Well, we focus on three distinct areas. And one of the first things I always like to let people know is that if you're a current student at Henry Ford College, you have access to our services. But also, if you're a graduate, which means you've graduated with a certificate or an associate level degree from Henry Ford College, and now folding in the bachelor level degree as well, you have access to our services for the rest of your life. So you can come back 10, 15, 20 years from now. We'll still be here. We'll still be there to help you out. We talk about what Career Services has to offer to our students. We break it down into three distinct categories. We talk about exploring. we talk about preparing, and then we talk about connecting. So when we talk about exploring, we're talking about those students that are coming in, want to have some background information about different career paths. They want to learn what it is that is available to them, as well as what the job market can hold and bear. So we focus on exploration. We're talking about really kind of getting students that aren't sure yet what they want to do. We help get them on the right path. Preparation is the second key thing that we focus our time on, and what we really try and do there is get our students as prepared as possible to go out into the world of work and have that kind of success. We talk about resume preparation, interview prep, cover letter prep, how to shake hands correctly, how to dress professionally for that first day on the job, all really trying to get them ready to transition from a college mindset to a professional mindset. And then the last thing that we do, which dovetails nicely with talking about the Career Expo, is we try and connect employers with our students. We have so many great students that are looking for part-time work, full-time work, seasonal, co-ops, internships. They want to go out and get that real-world experience, and employers want to hire them. And we try and spend a lot of our time in our office connecting them, connecting students and alumni with these employers that are looking for our students.
Is there a link between career services and maybe, you know, the academic counselors? You may have students who just don't know what it is that they want to do. And is there any interaction that way?
We always have students that are walked over from counseling saying, you know what, this student doesn't seem like they have locked in yet on what they want to do. And we tell them that's okay. You're not supposed to have all the answers for your entire life when you're 18 years old.
I was going to say, think you would at 18 years old.
Of course. Well,
ask them, they'll tell you, right?
A lot of 18-year-olds will tell you exactly what they're going to do without any idea of how to actually make that happen.
Sure.
But, you know, not to disparage 18-year-olds.
No, obviously. That's correct.
The key, of course, is to keep learning and to keep exploring. And if the only thing they know is what mom and dad do, or what my uncle does, or what my neighbor down the street does, and they think that's where what the jobs are. I can think back to when I was a kid, both my parents were teachers. I thought I was supposed to be a teacher. Didn't matter that I might not have been ideally suited for it. That's what I thought I was supposed to be, because I wasn't exposed to a lot of other things. So we really try and open their eyes and show them there are so many great jobs out there. There are so many resources they may not be aware of, and it's an important role.
Related to that, because we are in such a fast-paced sort of adjustment situation when it comes to jobs that didn't even exist 5 years ago, categories that didn't even exist 5 years ago, let alone the jobs themselves, how does your office stay on top of that, or how do you sort of put your spies out into the world to sort of be on the cutting edge of what's going to be big, what's big now, what's no longer big that was maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years ago?
The most common question I get is, what should I do with my life? And I'll say to a student, I don't know. I haven't lived your life. So to say that I know all the jobs, I'm always clear about saying I don't know all of them. I do a lot of research, and I go to a lot of conferences, and I read a lot of articles, and it's all with the idea of staying as up-to-date as possible. But I can honestly say that I don't tell students you should be a VCR repairman, or, you know, you should repair DVD players. They're going the way of the dodo. It's not going to happen much anymore. So we try and stay up-to-date on those sorts of things. But what we tell students is, there are so many great resources out there, and we have these open source resources that are really up to date and will project out job market for 10, 15, 20 years. The Department of Labor has huge databases that you can access and make use of, but so many students don't know what's available to them to figure that out. And we say you don't have to have all the answers, but you have to be working towards getting those answers. And as long as you're doing that, you're on the right path, and we're going to kind of be there to be a guide for you. I'll never tell a student what to do, but I'll be a sounding board. I'll be a resource for them to kind of bounce ideas off of and maybe help them hone in a little bit. And we have career assessments and things like that that can really be helpful in helping a student clarify their beliefs, their interests, their abilities, their skill set, their personality, all these different things that factor in. I've had a student come to me and say, I want to be a nurse, but I don't want to be in school that long, and I don't like blood. And I say, well, maybe this isn't the best fit for you. I've had students who are convinced that they're going to be entrepreneurs, but don't understand that they need to learn basic accounting, things like that. So at the same time, you're going to have to keep track of your own money. And we've also had tremendous success with students who come in and know exactly what they want to do, and they pursue it with that zeal. And that's one of the things I'm most proud of working at Henry Ford College, is how many students come in with that passion, with that interest, and they pursue it aggressively. And I love that.
Well, if you saw an 18-year-old Alan and 19-year-old Susan, give or take, we knew exactly what we wanted to do when we were that age. What are some of those opportunities that are out there right now? I mean, obviously, healthcare seems to be, health services seems to be a big thing with an aging population, but there's also the focus on trade skills and things that have sort of been underserved in an educational environment.
Well, the one thing that I'll say about Michigan is that we're a manufacturing state. That's what we are, and especially in Southeast Michigan, where manufacturing is always going to be a huge part of what we do. And so the skilled trades, you're right, is 100% going to be necessary in the future. And that's an industry that's continuing to grow, continuing to stay strong. So I will always advise students that if you've got a passion for it and you've got a skill set that matches with that, there's a lot of great jobs to be had out there. Energy technology, always going to be big. Electrical technology, huge. Again, not sleeping at all on the health careers, because those are booming. We have great programs here at HFC. I'm always, whenever I start listing off programs, I think about 30 other programs I never get a chance to get to. We've got a lot of great programs out here at HFC. I don't feel that there's a lot of programs that are sitting around with not much purpose. You know, if they're here and students are pursuing that, culinary, again, always going to be huge here at HFC. We've got great programs, and I tell students that if you've got the skill set and you've got the drive, you can get an education here that'll turn you into a good, marketable candidate upon graduation, which I'm proud to help them do.
Great. Chad Austin is with us in studio today, and we are talking about the Career Services Office here at the campus of Henry Ford College. Maybe you are a graduate of HFC, recent or otherwise. You know, this office is available to you for any of the different things that we've been talking about. Maybe you graduated 5 years ago and you still don't know what you want to be when you grow up. I mean, that happens, or something dramatic changes and you want to sort of start the exploration process again or get into that preparedness, and most importantly, when you're ready to make that connection to the businesses and the industries that are actually looking right now, well, we've got an option for you there as well. And that leads us to the Career Expo itself. So this is not your first rodeo with this, Chad, as I know, but at the same time, I, like any good, talented leader of an entity in our environment, I'm sure you strive to make this bigger and better, especially better. Not necessarily means bigger, right? You know, better is not always bigger, but to make this fulfilling to our students. So how does this process work, and tell us how to get involved?
Well, the Career Expo is the big event every year that we do. It's the cornerstone of what we try and accomplish in terms of bringing employers to campus. So it started out, we had around, 5-6 years ago, we had maybe 40 employers on campus. We did it in the cafeteria area of the M building, and it was great. And then we tried to expand from there. We've transitioned over to the gym, simply because Building H, because we needed the space, which I think is a great thing. And we're now, this year, we're up to around 100 employers. We'll have a waiting list of employers that would like to get to see us. But we try and cover the gambit. I mean, we try and make sure that every program has a representative of an employer that's looking to hire them. And we're pretty proud of the work that we've done there. So the expo this year is going to be bigger. It's going to be better. We're trying to group employers a little bit more specifically based on job function, based on areas they're looking to explore. We're marketing in new ways to students so they know what sort of jobs are going to be there, not just the list of companies. We have, some of the things that we're really proud of is this year we're going to have for the second or third year, we're going to be rolling out professional headshots free of charge. You can come over to our photo booth, and we have our professional photographer, Trenda, taking headshots for you. It's great for posting on your LinkedIn profile so you don't have that cropped out photo of you and half your face sliced off because you're cropping out next to your best friend. Having a nice professional headshot on LinkedIn always looks good. We're going to be doing a lot of different things to make it as effective and exciting as possible. We've extended the hours by another half hour, so we're going to have a little bit longer this year. All designed to just give you a chance to talk with as many employers as possible. Get those connections and then follow up with them, because Lord knows all it takes is getting a business card. It'd be really easy, but you've got to take the time to follow up, make those connections, and make them a lasting connection that'll hopefully net you a job in the end.
Yeah. How advanced can these talks get?
Very advanced, very quickly. We've had certain companies that have specific needs. And I mean, again, they're coming to HFC because they know what our student population is. They know what majors we have, and they know that our students can address gaps they have in their employment coverage. We've had a number of employers that have offered students jobs on the spot, which is still more pretty rare, but it does happen, you know, every year, and I'm always impressed by that. A lot of times it happens with the automotive. The automotive needs in Michigan are crazy. So if you've got some certifications in automotive, stop by. I guarantee you we'll have some employers that would love to talk to you.
In terms of the diversity of types of opportunities, you sort of alluded to that a little bit, but can you maybe give us some extremes of this type of business all the way to that type of business, like the A to Z kind of a thing?
Sure, of course. I mean, we'll have the Dearborn Police Department looking to hire officers. We'll have, I'm going to say it wrong, Hamade Educational Services looking to hire part-time substitute teachers. KLA Labs, which is one of is our principal sponsor this year, a great organization that's got really strong Dearborn ties. They're going to be sponsoring us. They need the Cisco program graduates to stop by, talk with them. KLA, A123 are always big supporters of what we're trying to do. So you name it, we've got, you know, the Ford Yacht Club's looking for hospitality and culinary. IHA's looking for customer service, financial services, healthcare. I mean, it really is the whole broad range of jobs. So if you've got a need for an employment, the Career Expo is where you want to be.
Do we have a requirement on behalf of the students to actually be allowed to come into this event, pre-registration? What should the student be prepared to do when they get there?
Absolutely. And one thing I want to say is we don't have any. It's open to the public. This is, you know, we are Henry Ford College. We're part of the Dearborn community. We want the Dearborn community members and Detroit community members and surrounding Southeast Michigan folks to come on in. This is open. We'll ask you if you're an HFC student, but that doesn't preclude you from coming in. We just want to track it for total purposes. You know, we just want to know what the totals are, whether it's a student, whether it's the member of the general public. Everybody's welcome. I will say that I encourage everyone to dress professionally. I can tell that employers look differently at someone who's wearing a nice sharp suit versus someone who shows up in a t-shirt and jeans. It's not to say that they can't get the job anyway, but you know, you want to do everything you can to make that great first impression.
Great. Resumes on hand, that kind of thing?
I always encourage people to have resumes. You want to give an employer every reason to say yes instead of a reason to have them have to follow up with you later. So if you can hand that resume to them saying, I want to work for you, I've done my research, I know that you were going to be here and I came specifically to talk to you, you're going to set yourself apart from almost any of the other candidates that are there that day.
Yeah, nice. In speaking about coming, I knew you were going to be here and I'm coming and I'm seeking you out so we can talk. This listing that you're referencing, will we have that in advance?
It's all connected online. You can Great. Check out the complete list, and we're adding to it every day. But every employer that's listed here is listed on our website, careers.hfcc.edu, so you can access that, pull up a complete list of employers. We're listing the job functions that they're recruiting for, so you'll know, hey, City of Detroit is looking specifically for information tech, social services, law enforcement. So if that's something you're interested in doing, check them out. These employers sometimes, I think, get pigeonholed based on what they do. Mm. Bell Tire isn't just looking for automotive technicians. They're also looking for customer service representatives. You don't need to be a gearhead to work at Bell Tire. You know, the Comerica Bank is not just looking for people that are business majors. They're also looking for people who can work in customer service, work in their HR department. So those sorts of things are important to know. And so we're trying to move beyond just the name of the company, defining what it is that they're looking to do.
And if those connections don't happen next Thursday, is there work that goes on the next 364 days to make these connections, right?
Well, you know, one of the things that we say is that if there's a week at HFC where we don't have an employer on campus, that's a week where we've kind of let the students down. If you go to the main buildings on campus, you'll generally see an employer there. Today we had two. There's at least one employer a week, usually. We're doing everything we can to market our students to employers. But the other thing I'd say is come into our office. We have an online system that is specifically for students here that has a number of jobs posted on a daily basis. Make use of that. Check in with us. If you're utilizing our services, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to find a job. Now, I want to make that real clear. Finding a job and getting a job are two very different things. The job market today is great. Finding jobs is very easy. Getting the job that you want is a little bit more challenging. But our first step, of course, is finding that job.
Right. And when we do our jobs properly, keeping the job can go hand in hand with getting it. So
how to do things the right way early on is very important, something we emphasize tremendously in the job.
Well, I saw that little side eye, Susan. I'm not sure what that means.
Oh, no. So one, that's funny. One other aspect, oftentimes what I hear from students is I don't think I'm ready. And even former students looking to get some work where I was didn't quite work out, and I'm looking to do something and more in my field than this. You know, this step in this direction, I want to step back into my direction a little bit. Sometimes for financial reasons, if that ideal job isn't there right when they graduate or shortly after, you know, you have to do something else. Mm-hmm. And that's understandable. So this is not just for people that don't have jobs. It could be for people that are looking for something, transitioning back into what it is that they studied or graduated with their specialty in or otherwise. But if somebody needs some support, even now, I mean, if this is next week, but if they're not ready with their resume, if they don't necessarily have the outfit that they think is going to make them feel confident enough to come to this event next Thursday. I know your office can help with that literally in the meantime, yes?
Absolutely. We do walk-ins all the time. So if walk-in days are specifically Tuesdays, but any day that you can stop by and say, hey, is there someone that can help me out? If we've got the time, we'll see you. We'll work on your resume. We love to have resume drop-ins. I've got it down to a crisp 15 minutes if I have to, but we can get you in there and get you that key information to get your resume looking sharp. The other thing that we have is our suit-up program. Through donations by the Dearborn community, through faculty, staff that have donated gently used professional clothing, we've actually put together a suit closet of professional wear that students can access and utilize. Now, I've had students say, can I borrow this? And I'll say, no, you can have it. We get donations, so there's low overhead for us. If a student can come in and find a suit that fits them, they can just have it. All they got to do is show us their ID to show us that they're a current student here at HFC, and they can walk out with a suit. Now, again, it's a single rack of clothing, and we're for male and female, and we're well aware of different body types and things like that. So if you really want to go out and take your game to the next level and get a nice suit at an affordable cost, we have resources in the Dearborn area that we can point you in the right direction to. If at the very least we know a list of Salvation Armies that have gently used professional wear, we'll get you looking good. And again, a black suit is a black suit. It doesn't have to say Armani on it to look okay. So we try and emphasize that point to our students.
That's great.
Are there opportunities for I guess sort of like mock interviews, being in that space and just sort of presenting yourself to another person as well?
Of course, we do mock interviews. If a student comes in and says, "Look, I'm interviewing with this company. I'd love to get some feedback on my interview strategies," I will pretend to be a person from that company. I will conduct an interview. At some point, I'll say, "All right, time out. Here's what you did well. Here's what you can work on." Very rarely do I make people cry. That has happened. No, I'm just kidding.
Better you than the other one.
Yeah, we try and keep it as constructive as possible.
Sure,
and we focus on getting students up to a place where they feel confident to be able to go in, interview, say all the right things, and not put their foot in their mouth. And, you know, it does happen. I mean, I've never seen a perfect interview where from top to bottom, front to back, nothing went wrong or there was flawless, because it's in the eye of the beholder. You know, you could think that you had a great interview and the interviewer might not like it all that much. So there's so many factors that are beyond our control. But what we work on is what you can control. What can you do to make sure that you're putting your best foot forward and that you're showing off the best side of yourself?
Great. I have to ask, because I'd like to, for whatever reason, put people on the spot. So I'm going to do that, Chad, if you don't mind.
Okay, sure.
So two follow-up questions, and they could be very few word answers if you want them to be. One of the biggest mistakes you see people make when going into an interview environment, and one of the biggest things that are not being done properly in the resume category.
Well, I'll give you two really good examples. Number one is if you interview with anyone, you need to send them a thank you note, handwritten, within 24 to 48 hours after you're done. I don't know why this has fallen out of favor or why people choose not to do it, but when I tell students you should send a thank you note, they look shocked. I don't know if it's a change in communication styles.
If they're like my kids, they haven't written anything in their own handwriting in quite a long time.
I guarantee if you send a handwritten thank you note, they will remember you. And it's a great opportunity for you to reinforce that you want the job, maybe even address something. You know, when you mentioned teamwork before, I had a great example, but that I didn't think of it at the time. Here's another example of teamwork I want to make sure I mentioned. It's a great resource, and it keeps them in your mind, or keeps you in their mind after the interview's over. So definitely send a thank you note. As far as resumes go, the biggest mistake I see is that people put down opinions about themselves. Teamwork, hard worker, team player, flexible, adaptable, excellent customer service. That's all what you think about you. And of course you like yourself. We assume that you're going to put down good things about yourself. It's filler. No one wants to hear what you think about you. What you need to do is put down facts. So instead of saying team player, say worked on a 5-person team and met every single sales goal in a 5-year period. Don't say adaptable, say adjusted schedule based on management's needs to cover a variety of shifts due to understaffing. That's an example. The example I always use is if you had to have your appendix removed, who would you trust? The doctor who comes up to you and says, Susan, don't worry, I'm a good doctor, I'll take real good care of you. Or the doctor who says, I've done it 115 times and never had a problem. Which one are you going to pick? You're going to pick the second one. First guy's, hey, you know, I haven't killed anybody in a week, but I'm really good. You know, so yeah, I'm a big believer in sticking to the facts. You cannot have opinions on your resume. No one really cares what you think about yourself. So that's my resume takeaway for you.
Great. Good tips. Thank you. You passed that one.
All right.
Yeah, or both of them, actually. Well, we're so happy to be a part of getting the word out about the Career Expo, as well as the Career Services Office in general. So would you just go through the particulars of this event coming up on October 17th one more time?
Sure. Next Thursday.
Yeah.
Next Thursday. From 1:30 to 4 in the H building, which is also the gymnasium on HFC's main campus. We're going to have over 100 employers on campus. Come on in, sign in, walk around, talk to these employers. It's a great chance for you to talk with some folks that are looking to recruit for a variety of positions all across the spectrum, all different types of jobs. So get there early, talk to as many as you can, shake hands, look them in the eye, make those connections, get those business cards, and follow up.
Right, and open to the general public.
Come on in. Everyone's welcome.
Great. A follow-up location for information should someone have missed something through our discussion today?
careers.hfcc.edu is our website. Click on that and just follow the prompts.
Okay. You make it sound so easy.
It should be. I wish it was.
Yeah, very good. Well, we thank you for your commitment and dedication to our students and to this community at large in helping to bridge these gaps and fill in the blanks so that that everybody can come out successful. We are looking forward to hearing after the fact. Love connections, right? Those
sure.
are always kind of fun. So thank you, Chad. All the best to you and hope it's a wonderful event.
Susan, Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, along with Susan McGraw. Thank you so much for being with us this Friday afternoon.
Attention, crafters and record enthusiasts. WHFR is hosting our very first Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar, which is taking place alongside our 12th annual record show on October 19th. We are still accepting vendor applications for both events. The 19th is fast approaching, so if you're a crafter or record slinger, be sure to send in your vendor apps for WHFR's Rock and Roll Craft Bazaar and record show as soon as possible.
Are you a local artist? Would you like to hear your music on WHFR? Please send us your music for airplay consideration. You can find our email and physical mailing addresses at whfr.fm. Don't wait. Send your MP3s, CDs, and records today.
Avant-garde. Transient. Cutting edge. Different. Come explore the new. The unheard. The forgotten. From Moog synthesizers to unique artists, a unique perspective, a unique musical experience. Space is the place. Experimental music at its finest. Space is the place, Friday evenings from 6 to 8, with your host, Tom Wilson, here on WHFR, Making Waves.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
61.